Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this episode, Bill Summers, president of the Permaculture Credit Union and a banker and businessman with over 30 years of experience, returns to talk about community development finance. During the conversation, we begin by talking about what this idea is and then move into the options available, the ways we can use banking and financial education to give someone a hand up instead of a hand out so that their lives are more stable and sustainable, and move into a general conversation of finance and the impact various practices have on both the consumer and society as a whole. I've enjoyed the two interviews I've done with Bill because he's able to take these ideas that to me are very heavy and largely impenetrable from the outside and demystify them into something very accessible. As permaculture practitioners, we take things like mushrooms and gardening and biochar, to name a few, and tie them together under the big top of permaculture, which thankfully have numerous clearly written books available to help us understand them. But banking? Finance? I haven't found anyone who can break those down into easy-to-understand pieces as well as Bill can. Plus, with his involvement in the Permaculture Credit Union, he has the ethical and principle-based understanding in common to the more visible structures of permaculture. He knows permaculture, what we're trying to accomplish with it, and how to get things done. If you enjoy this interview, the large catalog of past episodes, and look forward to future shows, please help me out. Take 2 minutes and tell a friend and leave a review on your favorite podcast site, and follow me on Facebook by searching for The Permaculture Podcast or on Twitter at PermacultureCST. You can also make a one-time or recurring financial donation by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Bill Summers. I'll join you afterwards with a few thoughts and some updates. If you could start us off on this idea of community development finance and ways that folks can use that to make a difference in their own communities.
The idea of community development finance is not a new idea. It's been around for quite a while. The way I worked my way into it was learning about the existence of an organization called the Community Development Financial Institution Fund, CDFI Fund, which is part of the Treasury Department in Washington. And their purpose is actually to help create what they call lightly regulated financial institutions, or CDFIs, and support them financially in order to serve underserved areas of the population. And by underserved, I mean both geographically, say rural areas, but also individuals, even in metropolitan areas, individuals that are referred to as unbanked or underbanked, where they don't have relationships with existing financial institutions. So the idea of community development finance kind of grew out from that, the existence of that organization. An example being what we do here at the Permaculture Credit Union. We aren't a CDFI because part of the charter, I'll say, for CDFIs is to focus a majority of their time and effort and resources on low-income individuals. That's by definition. So to become a CDFI, you have to have that as a charter or a purpose. We don't have that here, but a component of community development finance is a strong orientation to the community, which we do most definitely have here at Permaculture Credit Union. We're a big believer in that. We're located here in Santa Fe, but we have members in 45 different states where we have a rather large geographic footprint. And it's not as if we want to direct everything from here and try to control everything from here and define everything from here and then, I'll say, impose it on small local communities around the country. What we really want to do is partner with organizations and or individuals in communities around the country and work with them to, say, define loan programs, to learn about the needs of the community, and then figure out how we can bring some resources to bear to address what's going on in the community. A local example that I can use here is our microloan program for organic farmers throughout New Mexico. The entire loan program was developed in conjunction with two local organizations. And by local, I mean state, either here in Santa Fe or statewide. And it went so far as to, we defined the credit criteria, we defined the application process, we defined the overall relationship based on the needs of the farmers themselves, rather than our standing back and imposing conditions on the process. And what I'd like to be able to do is take that same attitude and transplant it in communities throughout the country, where we partner with a local organization or a local group or even local individuals to somehow bring financial services, in this case loans or loan programs, to the local communities. That's my orientation towards community development finance.
And then that process is to get individuals, those people who are underserved, whether they're geographic or, as you say, unbanked or underbanked, by offering those kinds of loan services, you help move people away from services like check cashing services that are going to take a percentage of that, or the title loan or payday loan organizations that have these very, very high interest rates that make it hard for someone to pay back, to give them a more traditional experience, and with that, lower rates?
Yes, lower rates is part of it. And the idea is, you're exactly correct, it's to offer a viable alternative for a couple of reasons, though. One is, let me go move up to 30,000 feet and start there and move down. The biggest thing that I see, and this isn't something you can attach only to like payday loans providers or title loan providers or even pawn shops or things like that, but these are things that large organizations do as well. And that is, they have a relationship with the community and they're basically extracting resources from that community, financial resources, and moving them elsewhere. You have an organization headquartered in, let's say, on the East Coast, and they have a branch or something or an outpost on the West Coast. Well, financial resources are going to be extracted and sent back to the East Coast from the West Coast, rather than cycled and maintained or retained within the community. That's the high-level view from my perspective. That's the damage done when there isn't a strong community orientation for investment or reinvestment. Bring it closer down to the individuals. One of the things that is tied to that approach from financial institutions like that, where they are, let's say, extractive, is their focus is exclusively on those products and services that will produce the biggest return for them. If you broaden the definition of community development finance beyond, say, just providing loans, and take it into a couple of other things, one of them being savings. It's great to have a title loan lender, but in the great grand scheme of things, individuals really need to have reserves, and that's savings. So you have to, in my opinion, from a community development finance perspective, it's not just financing something, it's also having a savings vehicle available to them for those rainy day problems that pop up. And that way they don't have to go back to the title loan for the extra $100. If you can make it easy for them to save and turn that into a habit for an individual, that's beneficial. A longer term benefit of that is you have an individual with, say, kids, and they see that behavior. They see the behavior. I mean, they see people borrow money, fine. I mean, you borrow money to buy a car, you borrow money to do something, to buy a house. But if you also see the behavior, the savings behavior as well, both from a basic share perspective or savings account perspective, as well as from, say, a CD or a share certificate, a longer-term perspective. You see that behavior going on, and that's very instructional. The third thing is, and this goes back to CDFIs, Community Development Financial Institutions, part of their charter, in addition to having, they're focusing a majority of their business on low income, is there are things called development activities that have to be built into their business plan. And by development activities, it isn't necessarily financial. It's not transactional. It's not like you have to make loans, you have to take savings or something like that. This is actually development things, personal development things, like, say, financial literacy training, as an example, where you have an 8-week course where someone comes in and learns about financial products and services so they can become more self-sufficient. You can also tie into that debt counseling where someone come in and, say, fill out the loan application, not to apply for a loan, but to just lay out their financial circumstances. They can sit down with someone and go through it. The best example I remember, having created a CDFI out on one of the reservations here in New Mexico, was an individual who was deeply in debt and mentioning the title loan companies, payday lenders. And she had 2 or 3 of those loans outstanding. And practically speaking, with everything remaining the same, she never would have been able to get out from under those loans. When you're rolling over and borrowing more money at 250% interest, it's tough to dig out from that hole. So we actually sat down with her, you know, made her a reasonably speaking, inexpensive loan at, I think it was 15 or 17%, and helped her out of that process. So you tie in the reasonable loan options, you tie in a savings capacity, you tie into that some educational opportunities, you tie into that some counseling things, and then in addition to that, there's other products and services that are available through community development financial institutions. One is free tax preparation, which on the face of it, you think of, well, H&R Block and these other companies are out there. Yeah, they are. And as far as I know, they do a fine job. But they also, as part of their business model, have what's called refund anticipation loans, which means someone comes in, have their taxes done, and they're going to get $600 back, let's say. Well, they pay to have their taxes done, whatever they charge. And then the person across the desk says, well, how would you like that money today instead of a couple of weeks from now? And next thing you know, here's effectively a payday loan. That here's your $600 today. We'll just lend it to you when your refund comes in. You'll just pay the loan back, plus interest of north of 100% for that couple of weeks. Out on the reservation, we offered free tax prep, and we had certified tax preparers, tax return preparers. We just did that for community members. So the community members saved first on the cost of the preparation itself, and because we wouldn't lend them the money in advance. It would be, well, the money's going to come in. When it does, you'll have your return and your refund will go on from there. Another product that is is available through a number of CDFIs is called an IDA account, which is a match savings account. And it's used for specific reasons, say education or first-time home ownership or something like that. And that's usually done in conjunction with, say, a state agency or a federal agency or something like that, where there are match funds available. If you meet this, you walk in and you have a goal. I want to save $2,000 over the next 2 years for a down payment on a house, or $5,000 over the next, well, generally it's only limited like $2,000 a year. I want to save $5,000 over the next 3 years for a down payment on a house. In some situations, there are individual development account programs where you can get anywhere from 2 to 4 times a match. So for every dollar you save, the partnering organizations will contribute $1, $2, $3, or $4 to what you're saving. And when you reach your goal, that money is available to use for that purpose. Community development finance in and of itself is not just making loans. It's tying together other financial services and support services to help folks not only just maintain, but to improve their circumstances and work their way towards self-sufficiency. It's generally kind of all encapsulated in what's called asset building. And it's so that folks, for individuals, so that was, like I said, they can have the accounts, they can move from, say, working with CDFI and move into a more traditional banking environment because they're in a better place financially, but they're also more familiar and comfortable with the whole banking and financial services process.
And by helping them to become financially literate through these processes, when they do make that transition to more traditional banking services, they're educated when they go in and know what to look for in a loan, what to look for when choosing a bank, what services they're going to need from that institution, and are able to make more informed choices as a result of all of this?
Yes, exactly. They know after going, say, through financial literacy about the whole budgeting. You know, a big part of financial literacy is budgeting, which is a home budget. So they're not only informed of the options available, say, from a financial products perspective, but they're also more able to continue to contribute to that cash cushion that everybody needs. Because if you're forever lurching from one dire circumstance to the next and relying on, say, payday lenders to get you out of that jam, it's kind of an unending cycle. Whereas if you can build some wealth, I'm not talking about retirement wealth or anything like that. I'm talking about having $500 socked away for when you need a car repair or something like that. I have a couple of different stages that I kind of envision for folks. It's, you know, having cash to just meet those emergencies. And then it's having actual some savings. And then if you look at this a continuum, then you look at, okay, you have cash in hand, you have some savings, then you have investments. And I'm not saying everybody in the world should move all the way through that continuum, but people become more secure financially as they move down that path. With my experience with CDFIs, I've learned that the lack of financial security, say an absence of financial security in a home, can be destructive. It can lead to all sorts of things. In my opinion, it can lead to domestic abuse. It can lead to alcoholism. It can lead to or contribute to drug use, things like that. It's just a lack of stability. I mean, it's like somebody who's always fighting one fire after the other can get tired of that after a while. If through this community development finance or CDFIs or, you know, that whole initiative, if we can help bring some stability to individuals and their families, I think the impact is greater than just, you know, somebody has a couple of dollars in the bank for a rainy day.
That financial capital that they would be building through this process has kind of a cascade effect in the rest of their life. And I think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, about needing to make sure that you have food and shelter and things like that. But in a world that requires money, unless you in some way exist outside of that, and I know there are a handful of stories about people who do, but for the majority of us, money is a part of our day-to-day lives, whether that's to keep the lights on or to put food on the table. And if you don't have that or some kind of security in that, whether that's a regular job you can depend on or, as you say, having that cushion behind you, then you're not really meeting your needs in a world that requires money.
Exactly. And part of that, bringing this back around a little bit to the Permaculture Credit Union, it's enabling the individuals to transact as well and to make it as easy and frictionless. And I don't want to say free. It's not free. There's a cost to it. But as reasonably priced, as utilitarian, it's having the resources and then being able to access them. It's having a reasonably priced credit card so that you can transact. It's not as if you want to go out and run up a bazillion dollars on your credit, on a line of credit. It's just that it's gotten, as you said, in this day and age, being able to just transact freely and conveniently without every single time you transact, there's some sort of fee attached to it. And I most certainly would never want to encourage someone to, say, overdraw their account. But in any given year, more than $30 billion, and that's with a B, in fees are charged for overdrafts. And that's either the straight overdraft, or it is even to be on a debit card. And the fees attached to all this stuff are pretty substantial. So getting back to the basic nature of finances these days at the individual level is, I see part of our role with this credit union is to offer a utilitarian, fairly priced, non-extractive products and services, rather than viewing them as these revenue streams that can just be expanded and expanded and expanded simply for the sake of generating revenue for the organization. In our last conversation, that was more specifically about the credit union, we look at our viability and sustainability as an organization all the time. That's part of my charter. But the other side of the equation, that's not our sole focus. Our staying in business and growing and growing and growing isn't our sole purpose. We have to be here to provide services to our members. And what we always want to keep in mind is, here's a product, here's its sustainability, and then here's its impact on the member. As a financial institution, we always have to keep those things in mind, which gets us back to the whole orientation towards the community. It's not as if we can't make up a loan program. And given our geographic footprint that we can't, you know, have a program in Toledo, even though we're here in Santa Fe, yes, we can. But when we do look at programs like that, we want to keep in mind our interest in the financial sustainability of it, but also its impact on the community. That's fundamental to community development finance. And in my opinion, it should be fundamental to every financial institution. Obviously, it isn't. But it's something that kind of connects us here at the credit union to that whole initiative of community development finance and the idea of community development financial institutions. As I said, that there's actually CDFI Fund. That's the name of it in Washington, and they are part of the Treasury. And not only do they encourage the development of, as I said, lightly regulated financial institutions, but they also provide subsidies to them. On a given year, there are funds, grant funds available that can be applied for by these CDFIs to support their operations and to provide lending capital to them. It's a competitive situation, but at least there's an interest on the federal government's part, and at least they recognize that there are pockets, groups, or geographic areas, or groups, or individuals that aren't being served by the existing network of financial institutions.
Do you see this kind of community focus from banking and community development finance as a way to help lift people out of poverty in a way that is productive both for them and for society?
Yes, I do. I really do. I see it as a bridge. I see its impact being much more longer term than just straight handouts. I'm not saying handouts aren't required. I'm not saying support isn't required. But it's support with an eye towards the future. I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons I wanted to build a CDFI previously is I think having a physical presence in the community is extremely important. It not only enables the ability to deliver the services. What I talked about earlier with the loan products, savings products, financial literacy training, free tax prep, individual development accounts, credit counts, and stuff like that, that's very hands-on. It's not something you can sit in New York and deliver in, you know, Santa Barbara, California. You have to have boots on the ground. You have to have people in the community. You have to have earned a level of trust that somebody from a big box bank, I'll call it, is going to open up a storefront in Topeka, Kansas, and have everybody in town just swarm all over them. It's not going to happen. You have to be members of the community. You have to be part of the community. You have to be active in the community. And then you engage the community members. And that engagement, as I mentioned earlier, is seen by all the generations involved. And it's a learned behavior. It's a habit. To this day, I still remember going to the bank with my father or mother decades ago, every week, every other week, whatever it was. And it's not as if I was ever sat down and said, this is what you do. It was, no, we participated. You saw it occur. And that's the type of thing that I think is fundamental to community development finance. And in our case, while we don't have a physical presence in all 45 states, we have an orientation towards that, and we have local partners that we want to develop over time. We're not just in there to, oh, here, let's offer a loan program, pull the money out and bring it back to Santa Fe. That's not the idea. The idea is to have almost revolving loan funds, for lack of a better term, that are earmarked for that program or that city or whatever the nature of the relationship is. I think it's not only a mechanical or physical thing for it to occur, but there's an underlying attitude that has to be tied to it so it doesn't go off the rails. So the impact is always delivered locally. That's the idea behind it.
As we talk about this, I'm wondering, how did you come to develop this kind of a mindset as a banker and someone involved in finance? Because it seems so counter to many of the news reports and everything else that we hear, that it's about profit and extracting and more money, more money, more money. But the story that you tell about the place that you're coming from and doing community development, that there's, I don't want to say a sense of altruism, because I think that at times that applies too much of giving. There's obviously a profit motive involved because of wanting to keep the credit union financially viable, to make sure that you and anyone else who's working there have a reasonable salary for the work that you do. Could you speak to how you came to this place personally and why this is the focus and motivation for you in this industry?
It took a while. Let me put it that way. When I first started in banking decades ago, I most certainly didn't have this attitude. I went through consumer banking. At one point, I worked for a finance company, which in its day was the title loan or payday lender of its day. And there were glimmers of what I'm thinking now that kind of popped up then. See, I felt uncomfortable about the rates that were charged. Then I moved down to a traditional bank, but still the same thing. Everything was volume driven. You know, you always wanted to make more loans this year than you made last. You wanted to be the biggest. One of our measures at that point was we were one of the 10 largest financial institutions in the country at the time, and you always wanted to move up that list. And then I moved into what I'll call commercial banking, where I was working with the bank, and we were actually lending money to the bank and transacting at the bank level, at portfolio level. Me personally, I wasn't working any longer at that point with individuals. And again, still the same thing. Bigger return, more volume. It goes from the old days when it was thousands, and it becomes millions, and then it becomes billions, actually. And I was on kind of that treadmill for a while, and I just got tired of it. What was a nice little organization became a really big organization, and it wasn't fun anymore. And so I just left. And then went through a couple of iterations with owning different businesses and stuff like that. And then moved from the East Coast and just picked up and left. Came out here to the Southwest. And it was working in a community that was truly needy. And, physically being there, which was one of the reservations. And to see there are people in the community used to joke, it would preceded the 08, 09 meltdown. Well, I actually kind of straddled it. And there were comments made that the impact on the entire country wasn't really felt on the reservations, because the horrible things that were happening in Milltown throughout the country had always been that way on the reservation. So it's like, okay, but this is business as usual. What's the big deal? When you work in a community like that and know people and have friends in there, and you see and you begin to think, okay, how can we try to improve the situation? Or how does it get this way? And you kind of move back up to the 30,000 foot level, and you see all the different activities within the community, on the edges of the community, or surrounding the community, things like that. And you just begin to think. And that's what got me on the path to the community development finance and the community-oriented finance. And trying to take my, you know, what I'd learned, all the tools I'd gathered over the years and experience, and try to actually improve the community as compared to, you know, improve my personal take, we'll call it. And it's not, you know, I'm not donating. I get paid for what I do. But again, getting back to the other side of the coin, there's a financial return, there's an impact. And for what we'll call it right now is there's a financial return and there's a psychic return. And son of a gun, when you begin to balance those and that needle shifts from all I care about is a financial return 100%, and that becomes, there's, well, I want a financial return, but I have an equal interest in a psychic return. So now there's a 50-50 split between that. That's what kind of turns you. And when you can see somebody that you can make an impact on a person, and you can actually sit down and talk to them. And when you see them, you know, around, you see how much different they are and how much different their kids are, and their bills are paid, and they now have insurance, and the car is running. You know, it's that type of thing. So you kind of start up with the 30, you know, you move up the 30,000 foot level, you move back down to the individual level, and then you move back up again. And you say, okay, we did it once. Why can't we do it twice? Why can't we do it 100 times? Why can't we do it 1,000 times? Why can't we, you know, things like that. That's the transition. But I can't sit down with somebody that I used to work with and say, oh, this is cool. You actually have to actually have them experience it, I think, to go through that transition, or to have experienced something, or to have that inclination from birth. You know, there are folks in community development, let's say just basic community development, or as compared to community development finance, or that I've worked with in nonprofits, that have always been that way. I guess I'm just a latecomer to the whole process. I didn't realize all these cool benefits, personal benefits, were out there for me. It just took me a lot of moving around, a lot of other stuff, to get to this point when other people were there from all along.
Well, I'm glad to know that you came to this place and are making this difference with all the knowledge and experience that you have in that previous world.
I'm an eternal optimist. The situation arises, I'm not going to sit there. My first inclination is, okay, that's the circumstance, fine. How can we fix it? Because there is a way to fix it. And I also believe that when I said, okay, we did it once, twice, 10, 100, 1,000, a million, I'm convinced we can do this a million times. We can. We have all the tools. It's just a matter of marshaling the resources and having the, like the credit union does, which is what attracted me to the credit union, the ethical underpinnings of the organization. And you know it's going to stay that way. I know the board and this organization is never going to go off the rails. We're never going to have built a skyscraper. And we're never going to have 87,000 branches. And I'm never going to receive a golden parachute. I have no interest in it. As long as we can bring all that to bear and keep it, this is going to happen. It's just a matter of time.
Knowing that you're out there and that the Permaculture Credit Union is available as one resource, if someone wants to connect with community development finance to help their friends and neighbors and anyone else that they may know that are underserved, what path would you recommend for them to find local resources and to get involved to make a difference?
The big thing is to, it's going to sound odd, but the big thing is define the community you want to serve. And that's not so much a geographic thing. I mean, granted, my experience it was as a reservation is geographically bound. Here it is. But say within a city, you want to serve underserved. Underserved what? And, you know, you have to be able to identify the group you want to work with. In many cases, people have already done that, which is why they're looking for solutions to the process. So once they've identified the community they want to work with, I'm not going to say, oh, it's a no-brainer. You fill out a two-page thing, send it in, they send you money, everything's done. That's not the case at all. But there are resources out there. And it's going to sound odd, but I would refer them directly to the folks in D.C. at cdfifund.gov on the website. They are responsive. They are helpful. There's the National Federation of Community Development Credit Unions. There's any number of organizations out there and funding sources that can help out. The CDFI fund itself, you can apply for a grant to help you develop your organization. You don't have to have one, but you don't have to have a CDFI that exists, but you can receive grant funds to help you develop for infrastructure development, for training, to pay some of the salaries. It's called technical assistance. That can be applied for. Given my orientation, that would be my inclination, would be to go that way. Because I think the most productive way to approach this, both in the near and the long term, is to approach it from a sustainability perspective. It isn't to view it as, well, I'm going to go out and get grants and I'm going to, you know, hand out stuff. I really think you have to, as you pointed out earlier, you have to help folks increase their capacity. And more often than not, it's being in the community. It's being a resource. It's having the information. It's spending the time. A financial literacy training course that goes over 8 or 10 or 12 weeks isn't a minor thing. That's a lot of time commitment for both the people delivering it and the people participating. But it's really beneficial. But when all is said and done, the people who graduate from the course are one step closer to, we'll say, self-sufficiency, for lack of a better term. I think the biggest first step is to figure out and to be able to define this is the community, and by community, like I said, it's not geographic. It could be a type of, it could be people in this area, but it could also be, as an example, our microloans. Yes, they are only in New Mexico, but they are earmarked for and oriented towards organic farmers. So that's that community that's served. But in the same geographic area, I could work with not organic farmers. I could work with, say, food distributors or something like that. It's figuring out who you want to work with and how you want to do it and how you can improve it. And once you have a rough idea of that, then you can make a case for here are some funds to help address the circumstances. But also, again, the attraction of where I am now is that this is a financially sustainable business that we can use, and we can use the resources generated by it instead of for golden parachutes and mahogany paneling. We can use to reinvest, to continue the outreach process, to continue the information delivery process in some situations, to continue the educational process or product development process in new parts of the country. I mean, recently I was having a conversation with someone, and we had several conversations, the idea of setting up a kind of like an investment fund or to support small businesses in their community. We've been through this process quite often, and we were looking at it from an operational perspective, and I discovered doing research here is that we have the capacity here to support what I'll call an investment club. You get six people together without any formal organization, but they want to deposit funds here in the credit union. They could get together and as a group decide to support, say, a small business person or three or four small business people with loans. And we could actually kind of parcel that loan securitization, I'll say, between the different depositors to different, you know, it's kind of an intriguing idea of, instead of having a formal organization support a loan program, we actually have the capacity to just have 6 or 8 or 10 individuals get together on their own and support a small business, 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. So, like I said earlier, we have all the tools, or many of the tools. We're still developing them. But it's something that, once we bring them to bear, we are going to just see bigger and bigger and bigger impacts.
You've reached the point where you can take everything that you have and bring them to bear on the problem as these resources come available to begin to see those bigger and better changes, making larger, more impactful differences on the members that you serve.
Exactly. In every phase, not only, again, well, we have to look at the entire financial continuum, from loans to savings vehicles to transactional tools like credit cards and things like that, as well as to providing the information so folks are better informed. It's a whole assortment of things. And in all of those, supported by, I don't want to use the word ethical, but supported by an orientation that includes the consideration of the impact on the participants as well as the financial return.
There are many broad emerging ways in which to help people along this way, not just the usual means that we think of having a loan or a credit card. Different ways to apply the tools are still emerging as these ideas of refocusing and developing the community continue to grow over time.
The biggest one in our case is, we're going to be introducing a website in the next couple of weeks. And the biggest component of it, it's not groundbreaking by any stretch of the imagination. It's not a huge departure visually from what we currently have. But the big thing is, we're building in the ability to respond to us and communicate with us, not only just go to the website and see what's up there and see the information, but for us to push information out, not just post it, but actually actively push it out to people on a distribution list, and also to have them respond. I really think there's a value in not just sitting here and dreaming stuff up and then going off and doing it, but input from all different sources. It's one of the things we try to do with our board is, we want to have a variety of folks. I mean, obviously, we want to have some technical, some banking folks. You want to have some legal folks. You want to have, you know, accounting folks. We also want to have community. And by community, not just local Santa Fe, but people in the quote-unquote sustainable community. You want all this input. And the nice thing is, with the Internet, is they don't need to be board participants, but they can, when we send out, say, a newsletter or news brief or something like that, they can respond to it and put their 2 cents in. I mean, I read an article recently that said there was a survey done concerning financial literacy, which is what kind of got my eye about the article to begin with. And a question on the survey was, if you had $100 in a savings account that earned 2%, after 5 years, how much money would you have? And over half of the adults that answered that question said $102, when, just to simplify it, it is at least $110, and that's excluding the compounding effect of interest on interest. So the point of the article was that if that question stumps folks, then a majority of folks, then what about a 6 or 8 page credit card disclosure, or a, I don't know how many pages, mortgage agreement? It's realizing that that type of stuff, that circumstance exists, and just trying to be able to get the right information out to individuals and to get their response back saying, well, that's not what I actually need. This is what I actually need. And to do that from our perspective on a national basis because of our field of membership, that's what I find one of the areas with the greatest potential.
Just like applying permaculture in the design of the landscape, it sounds like there's a lot of work that can be done on improving financial literacy, and with that, offering appropriate products within a financial system.
I know financial literacy has this whole, well, you have to go to class. No, it's being able to converse. It's being able to realize the impact. It's being able to realize, to actually understand the costs that you're incurring. If you look at the simple transaction, you borrow $100 today, you pay back $107 in 7 days. Okay, you look at it and go, okay, it's $7. I really needed the money, great, you know, at that time. So it was worth it. Well, that's it's $1 a day. That's a 360% interest on that. So you're better served to have $400 in a savings account than paying 360% interest on to borrow money. It's like paying yourself 360% interest. It's just being aware of the nickels and what they always say. If you take care of the pennies, the dollars will take care of themselves. It's the whole idea behind that. Except in the country, it's just a really big volume. So the impacts can be substantial.
Just by making those little changes so that someone doesn't have an overdraft fee at $29.99 or whatever it is per transaction. I mentioned that number because that was an overdraft fee that my bank charged a decade ago when I had my identity stolen, and the people who did that ran up a whole bunch of charges in one night. And this was, you know, back before everything could be cleared and checked instantly. So all this stuff came due the next morning, and it was, I couldn't tell you how many hundreds of dollars just in overdraft fees, in addition to, I think it was like $2,200 that my account had been overdrawn because of how quick and hard they had hit it. You know, I was able, because it was identity theft, to go back and work through a lot of that, not have to pay those fees, recover at least a portion of the money. But if this is someone who's in a case where they need that $100 right now to pay something and they're kind of, you know, taking from one place to pay another, how quickly that can add up. Especially if your income is only a few hundred dollars a week, to have 10 or 15 or 20% of your weekly income disappear because of some overdraft fees. And that $30 billion figure you represented earlier, just using what I was charged as an example, that means that there's a billion overdrafts occurring every year in the United States if they're all being charged that amount. And that's crazy.
In some situations, circumstances make it perfectly reasonable. But what has happened is that the population overall is rational. And studies have been made that people will actually sit there and say, okay, I can bounce a check, it'll cost me this amount. Or I can go to this payday lender and they'll cost me this amount. And they will decide which is less expensive. In fact, I read something not too long ago about a comment that if you drop, the financial institution reduces their overdraft fees, they improve their financial performance because they're kind of competing against other alternatives. You don't see taking a loan out or bouncing a check as replacements for each other, but in fact they are. It's informing individuals, it's working with them, supporting their efforts to, say, save some money just for that $100 or $200 thing that they might encounter. It's not a minor thing. As you said, it adds up both on an individual and on the national level. And the impact isn't dissimilar relative to who or what's being impacted. An individual being impacted by, you're right, the $29.95 fee or $30 fee, and the nation being impacted by the $30 billion in fees, they're equally substantial.
And every little thing you can do to keep that kind of money from being extracted by those end users allows more to be returned to the community and that individual's needs, as opposed to not having it available when they might encounter one of these emergencies later, which then, as you say, leads that person to be more self-sufficient, sustainable in their own financial future, which then allows that community to be more self-sufficient and sustainable because of the other options that become available, rather than having to give so much money to overdraft fees or high interest loans. I'm just thinking through this entire conversation and all the places that it leads and how having these different instruments that, I mean, honestly, until we talked about it, I didn't know about most of these vehicles that were available or the idea of the Community Development Finance Fund through the government and some of the other stuff, these lightly regulated financial institutions. It's amazing how much I didn't know walking into this. I mean, thinking about, you mentioned the mortgage and having had to sit down and read through one of those and ensuring that what I initialed was what was supposed to be initialed and understanding what my mineral rights were versus my water rights versus, in Pennsylvania at least, it seems coal is a separate mineral right than the others, and that was something that was enumerated in the mortgage as part of the title and deed that went with that. And thinking about how this literacy impacts so many people and these little changes that we can make through invisible structures to make a difference in the lives of the people around us and how that relates to the permaculture model and how, as we're doing development to build permanent agriculture, that these other pieces help us to build a permanent culture and the way that all that interacts in creating sustainable communities. It's really crazy to think just that banking and finance has such a role, but when you look at what $30 billion could do to have that available and not being drawn out from something else, it's just incredible.
In individuals' pockets, that's exactly it. And then the multiplying factor, if it's invested in local communities, it's just, yeah. As I said, take care of the pennies, the dollars take care of themselves. If you take care of the individuals, the communities will take care of themselves. I think the ideas aren't dissimilar.
And the more that we get people able to take care of themselves and their communities, the less those individuals and communities need additional assistance. We can really move past that point of, well, as you said, those handouts, by giving a hand up in the appropriate places and in the right ways, you remove people needing a hand out in the end. That's pretty powerful.
Well, that was one of the discussions we had with my board when I was developing the CDFI originally years ago. Their initial take was, well, we want 2% loans. We had any number of discussions about that, or 1% loans. And it was, you have to make the institution sustainable. Otherwise, you're forever dependent on handouts to keep the institution in place to help deliver all the services. It's trying to avoid this race to the bottom of rates and prices. There's a reasonable cost for things. There's a reasonable price for things. And even in credit unions, it's being observed that this perpetual competition for lower and lower rates has made loans, or higher and higher rates on the savings side, has made loans and share accounts not sustainable. So the revenue streams that have to be increased are all the fees. And it's just a cycle that should be broken or needs to be broken. And we have to recognize that more and more and more is not better. Cheaper and cheaper and cheaper isn't better. There is a big spot in the middle. We'll call it a sustainable area that we should be residing in and aiming for.
That place where you balance the value of your services against what's required to be sustainable. And I think about when you talk about fees, if you charge fees on the front end for your banking, then you cut out the people who can't afford the upfront fees. But then at the same time, if they're back end fees, then the people who can afford them aren't concerned about them because they may never be charged for them. But those people who are in that underserved category are the ones who are most likely to be the ones who are impacted by them, which then reinforces that system.
Mm-hmm. So, and also, I can support the idea of charging somebody a double-digit interest rate. It could be lack of security. It could be lack of credit history. It could be bad credit history. There's any number of things. You're forever balancing risk and return, what you said earlier. You're forever balancing. You're valuing your services and what you're receiving for them. You're valuing your products, what you're charging for them. there is an appropriate level for all of that. Sometimes I know our rates are looked at as either too high or too low, but they're sustainable. By approaching every product and making each of them sustainable as compared to, well, here's three that we'll call this the entire loss leader side, and we're really going to offset all of that with these other products over here. It just skews everything. And you really have to step back, take a deep breath, and say, okay, what's reasonable? I'm always kind of intrigued when there's this perpetual, you know, big box mentality of, well, I can go here and pay less. I can take this receipt that says I paid, you know, $1.29 for this here and take it over here and get it for $1.19 or $1.09, whatever it might be. So this perpetual price comparison, it's unending. Now, the same people that do that when they're out buying something, if that same tack was taken where they work and what they're paid with a, well, I've got somebody who can come and do your job and I'll pay them 5% less tomorrow, if that was done on a daily basis. There is a nice middle. There's a nice medium area for everything, for what we're paid, for what we pay, what we're charged, what we charge. There's a happy medium for all of this. And in my opinion, not only a happy medium, but a sustainable and a very productive medium, because that's when you are able to get off this 100% focus on return on investment, 100% focus on cost, 100% focus on price, 100% focus on revenue, and you bring into that picture the psychic value or cost of all this stuff. That entire side of the equation appears to be lost at this point, and we're trying to retain it here, and I think we are.
And I'm thankful that you are, and serving as a model for anyone else who is interested in making a difference in their community and looking for different models to make that happen. As with the last time we had our conversation, you've introduced so many things that it's going to take me quite a while to get through all of it and put the pieces together in a way that's meaningful for me. But rather than keep you for much longer, is there anything else that you'd like to add to this conversation?
No, we've covered quite a bit, and this is kind of intertwined. This wasn't solely community development finance. This gets back to financing in general, and credit unions are one way to do it. CDFIs are another, banks are another. I personally support the combination of impact and investment and return on investment. The more we can get that idea out there, and that there is a happy medium with all of this, and just be able to start the conversation. It's not going to be acceptable to everyone. Not everybody's going to agree. I would suspect a vast majority of people will not agree. But I think it's something that we just need to keep putting out there, and information we need to keep getting out. And I don't want to say education, but educating folks. And we also need to take a long-term perspective. This isn't something that, well, we're approaching the end of the first quarter, by the end of the third quarter, this will all be done. Well, it won't be, because the impact of this, in my opinion, is multi-generational. But since my first step into this as far as managing an institution was kind of a small step into the CDFI side, the lightly regulated side. But being involved in the completely full bore regulated side and being able to participate in this market and attach this philosophy and attitude to it, I think is an important step. And I think it's one that we haven't begun to see the impact, the positive impact. It's going to be years from now. I think it's going to be substantial when that time comes.
Well, as I find that to be my role, to get information out there, I will do my best to share this with the world so people are aware of it and have an idea of where they can go to look for these kinds of tools, as well as finding that happy medium within their own lives. So it's not always just chasing the highest interest rate or the lowest price, but finding something of value and meaning to themselves beyond just dollars and cents. Thank you so much, Bill, for taking this time again to join me. I appreciate the conversation and everything that I've learned about finance and what we can do to make a difference in our own community using these tools. So thank you very much.
I'm happy to contribute. If there's anything else I can do, just let me know.
And that was Bill Summers of the Permaculture Credit Union speaking about community development finance. Though we have alternative economic options in the permaculture literature with things like local exchange trading systems, LETs, bartering, time banking, and local currency, what gives me hope from this conversation with Bill is that here's another way to approach banking and finance a bit differently, but in a way that can engage the system that currently exists. I agree with that idea given to us by Ethan Hughes and reiterated by Lisa Fernandez and others, that we need to meet people where they're at to make permaculture more accessible and desirable by the public in those areas that aren't hungry for it yet. And as we get the physical structure designs down, the invisible becomes more important as we move our work towards community and permanent culture. For that reason, in addition to Bill coming on to talk about banking and finance, I also invited Adam Brock of the Grow House to come back and speak about his work on invisible structures and the development of an invisible structure pattern language. That interview's already been recorded, and I'm in the process of editing it, so expect that sometime on March 22nd. After that will be Josh Robinson of the San Diego Sustainable Living Institute. We begin with his journey to permaculture, which is very reminiscent of, though in a different way, of my long trek to today. Expect that March 26th or 27th. And after that, we have Eric Tonesmeyer returning to talk about a book he's working on about how we can use perennial crops to sequester carbon, stabilize soil, and also provide the base materials that we need for industry so that civilization, more or less as we know it, can continue forward. And that should be with us on March 29th or 30th. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.